طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with a CNN interview with Palestinian attorney and Rutgers University professor Nora Erekat. It is a couple of months old, but I play it to offer an example of the American media's approach to discussing the Palestinian struggle. The questions reveal that they think this is a symmetrical struggle between equals rather than a military occupation of a colonized people. But Nora brilliantly turns the interview into a projection of the Palestinian narrative.
My next guest says the world has become desensitized to the violence in Gaza. Nora Erekat is a human rights attorney, professor, and author of the book Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. She is highly critical of Israel's actions, calling the attacks in Gaza crude colonial violence. And Nora Erekat joining me now via Skype from just outside of Washington. And you are a Palestinian. And I just wonder, before we talk about specifically what is going on the ground, to describe just what it feels like looking from the outside in, as it were.
Thank you so much, Becky. I appreciate centering that question and what it feels like to be a Palestinian, because so much of what's at stake is actually our dehumanization and the expendability of our lives, livelihoods, that our deaths become numbers rather than vanished dreams and mourning families. As I'm watching this, I'm having intense emotions. I was in Jerusalem in 2000 at the start of what's known as the Second Palestinian Intifada. I was there when one of the first of the five people killed on September 21, 2000 was one of my neighbors in Abu Dis. I remember vividly his toddler daughter beating on a picture of him calling for her Baba. I'm also then reminded immediately of my cousin who was murdered last summer at a checkpoint separating two Palestinian cities. Ahmed Ariqat, I want to lift up his name because he remains in captivity in an Israeli refrigerator at Tel Aviv University, held as hostage and not allowing his family, my family, to mourn him with dignity. I'm now bracing myself because on the one hand, I am invigorated by what is a Palestinian uprising against this colonial rule, and simultaneously bracing myself because I understand and see that Palestinian death has become an index for Israeli vulnerability because of the thorough dehumanization of our lives.
What we are witnessing today and overnight is this uptick in, I don't want to call it tit for tat, strikes from Gaza and then on the back end from Israel, because tit for tat just dismisses the enormity of what is going on. But this has come off the back of recent violence in Jerusalem. And in a recent op-ed, you said, and I quote, Sheikh Jarrah is the latest flashpoint of Israel's expansionist project. The threats of eviction are part of what Palestinians describe as their ongoing Nakba, because the removal and forced exile of 80% of historic Palestine's native population between 1947 and 1949 was not a singular event. We spoke to Mark Regev earlier on, the foreign ministry, of course, describing what is going on as in Sheikh Jarrah as a real estate issue. Elaborate, if you will, on what you wrote in that op-ed.
Absolutely. I co-authored that op-ed with Maryam Barghouti, a freelance journalist and researcher in Palestine, who is in the West Bank. And because of, she's Palestinian in the West Bank, but because of Israel's violent juridical demarcations and its settler colonial plans of dividing Palestinians and eliminating them as a people, she cannot travel to Jerusalem and instead, like me, is watching it from afar despite her proximity. I heard the interview with Mark Regev. I had a lot to say to him, especially as he was sharing propaganda that Jerusalem has been the home to what he described as Arabs, he should have described as Palestinians, despite the fact that the Israeli government has been explicit about removing Palestinians. In its Jerusalem Master Plan of 2000, it says explicitly that it wants to maintain a demographic majority of Jews of 70% to 30%, and needs to do that because natural population growth of Palestinians will become 60 to 40. And so they have pursued a policy of removal through state annexation, through forced evictions, through retroactive taxes, through the declaration of land as state parks that are now off limits to Palestinians. 14,000 Palestinians have had their residency permits revoked since 1967 without due process. When Israel annexed Jerusalem in full daylight in contravention of international condemnation in 1967, it expanded Jerusalem's municipal boundaries by 10 times and annexed some 17,000 additional West Bank acres of West Bank land. Since then, the Israeli government has built some 49,000 housing units for Jewish Zionists in Jerusalem, but not a single one for Palestinians, who constitute a third of the city's population. Nothing here speaks of equality. This is a settler colonial campaign to remove native Palestinians and to replace them with Jewish Zionist settlers in their place. Every Palestinian removed today from their home is not suffering from a real estate dispute, but faces their life now as a refugee for the rest of their life.
The rockets that are being fired by Hamas from Gaza, they say, are in response to what is going on in Sheikh Jarrah and in response to the violence, they say, that Israel has waged against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque over the past couple of days, over the Middle East weekend. Do you support that response by Hamas? This is an organization that many will say is filling a void where otherwise a wider Palestinian leadership might be. It's no secret that there has been a vacuum in Palestinian leadership. The Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, has temporarily postponed the elections. Many say that that actually suits him. So I do want to put it to you. Do you support Hamas's response? And what of Palestinian leadership at this point?
Let me just say that it really doesn't matter whether or not I support it. And unfortunately, I think that the focus on Hamas rockets, which have been ineffective. Israel has protected itself with the Iron Dome system. Hamas has crude rocket fire that does not have the ability to target, is ipso facto reckless, and indicates the deep asymmetry in this conflict, which we should emphasize, which is a maldistribution of power that cannot be reduced to false parodies. And oftentimes when I'm asked this question about how I feel about this rocket fire, it's a litmus test about my own moral compass. So here, let me affirm that Palestinians have the right to use force under international law in order to fend off racial discrimination and colonial regimes. This law and this right is enshrined in a moment where the majority of the world was under colonial rule and domination. Now that we're in 2021, that seems incredibly anachronistic. And rather than focus on the absurdity that this colonialism remains intact by the one of the 11th most military powers in the world, the only nuclear power in the Middle East. Instead, we are focusing on the tactics that Palestinians are using. That said, I think that the emphasis should be on lifting the siege on Gaza. They remain in an open-air prison. And as Israel now initiates a bombardment of the Gaza Strip, I want the audience to know that Palestinians cannot even become refugees of war because Israel has sealed those borders.
Where is the United States in all of this? And I ask you that because many leaders from around the world and indeed in the Arab region have reacted. We have heard nothing from the White House, or certainly from the U.S. president himself. But I do want you to have a listen and respond to the exchange between Ned Price, the White House spokesman, and a reporter. Have a listen, Nora.
Do Palestinians have a right to self-defense?
In broadly speaking, Saeed, we believe in the concept of self-defense. We believe it applies to any state. I don't think that... I certainly wouldn't want my words to be construed as...
I understand. I want to ask you, and I don't want to harp on this either, but... You know, the Israelis killed 13 people just now, you know, including maybe 5 or 6 children. Do you condemn that? Do you condemn the killing of children?
Saeed.
I'm asking, do you condemn the killing of Palestinian children?
Obviously, and these reports are just emerging, and I understand, I was just speaking to the team, I understand we don't have independent confirmation of facts on the ground yet, so I'm very hesitant to get into reports that are just emerging. Obviously, the deaths of civilians, be they Israeli or Palestinians, are something we would take very seriously.
With respect to Ned Price, let me just let our viewers know, Nora, that that was an exchange that happened yesterday evening, U.S. time. But what do you, and he is the State Department spokesman rather than the White House spokesman, so my mistake there. But what do you make of Washington's position at this point?
Washington's position has remained consistent when it became Israel's primary patron in 1967 under the Lyndon B. Johnson administration, where it talks out of both sides of its mouth by providing unequivocal military economic support to Israel at the same time that it offers empty platitudes about peace and the two-state solution, which is essentially a liberal veneer for Israel's settler colonial expansion and violence. The Biden administration has signaled that it is no different than the Trump administration, which the world, you know, was uproarious about because of his flagrant, brazen violence and disrespect of human rights. And yet the Biden administration has not changed course. When Trump moved the embassy, the U.S. embassy, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the world was uproarious, and Palestinians said, "We're not mourning the loss of a capital of an inchoate state. We are now mourning the fact that we are told that we don't belong." And here is the Biden administration literally overseeing our removal based on the statement that we do not belong there and can be removed and placed anywhere else.
With that, we will leave it there. We are, though, delighted to have you on today. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. A Palestinian perspective there with Nora Erekat.
Well, there you have it. In the face of a brutal military occupation, the media focuses on Hamas rockets, a major talking point of the Israeli lobby. Nora turns it into a teaching lesson on the international right to resist an occupation. That is making lemonade when they offer you lemons. And now on to our feature presentation by Edward Ahmed Mitchell, who was an attorney and former journalist who serves as the deputy director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States. Here he is speaking at the Washington Press Club. We begin with his introduction.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for the introduction. I didn't know you were going to do that long introduction, but I appreciate it nonetheless. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with all of you. Good morning. Assalamu alaikum, shalom alaikum. May peace be upon all of you. I hope you are doing well and staying safe. I'm Edward Ahmed Mitchell. As just mentioned, I'm the Deputy Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations based in Washington, D.C. On behalf of our entire civil rights organization, I thank you for hosting this event and inviting us to participate. I also want to thank you all for the accommodation allowing me to appear virtually. My wife and I are expecting a new addition to our family soon, God willing, so I am staying close to home and avoiding crowds. But it's a pleasure to be with you virtually, and I hope to see all of you in person one day soon, God willing. I've been asked today to speak about the issue of surveillance, of infiltration, of the intersection between anti-Muslim bigotry, anti-Palestinian racism, and how extremists who share both of those ideologies have attempted to target the Muslim community in order to undermine our advocacy for Palestinian human rights. This is an issue that is very important to our community, and I think it's an issue that's very important to our country, and I'm happy to discuss it with you today. Before I dive in, I want to start by telling you a little bit about CARE, our organization. So first and foremost, CARE is our nation's largest Muslim civil rights organization. We were founded back in 1994. Our mission is to promote justice, protect civil rights, empower American Muslims, and enhance the public's understanding of Islam. We've been doing that now for almost 30 years. We are known very much for winning important court cases, defending the right of Muslims to practice their faith, to engage in free speech. Relevant to all of you, we have defeated multiple anti-boycott laws in multiple states, including Georgia and Texas, and we're continuing that important work. We also vocally speak out for not only civil rights here at home, but human rights overseas. We've been very critical of the Chinese government over its ongoing genocide of Uyghur Muslims. We've been very critical of the UAE and Saudi Arabia for the war crimes they're committing in Yemen. We've been very critical of Myanmar for the ethnic cleansing of Rohingya Muslims. And of course, we've been very critical of the Israeli government for the ongoing occupation and oppression of the Palestinian people. All of that work together has made us, you could say, enemy number one for anti-Muslim hate groups here in the United States. There is no Muslim group they hate more than CARE. All you got to do is Google our name and you will find that they obsess over us. We get to, as the kids say, live in their heads rent-free, so to speak. And we take that as a good sign. The fact that they hate us so much is a sign that we are doing good and important work. But we also are hated by people around the world who support injustice and oppression. We have had to deal with literally foreign dictators and foreign governments targeting our organization. Give you a few examples. The United Arab Emirates literally put us and numerous other Muslim groups on a list of terrorists. They designated as terrorists because we advocated for the right to free speech, the right to protest, the right to vote during the Arab Spring. The Bush administration put a CARE and numerous other American Muslim groups on a list of unindicted co-conspirators during a trial back in around 2007, 2008. Last year, Chinese hackers launched a massive cyber attack on us in an attempt to take down some of our systems that failed. It was actually very serious in response to our criticism of what's being done to Uyghur Muslims. And here in America, of course, as I mentioned, not only anti-Muslim hate groups target us, but any groups that are considered mainstream parts of the community, like the Anti-Defamation League, are very hostile and very publicly critical of our civil rights work. And so I say all that to say that when you are out there on the battlefield of civil rights, when you're advocating for justice for all people, it's dangerous work. It attracts a lot of enemies. We expect that. We account for it. We're used to it. We can deal with it. We're big boys and big girls. That's part of the job of being a civil rights attorney. The NAACP was called anti-American and communist back in the day. We all know what was said about Dr. King and Brother Malcolm and others. Again, this is part of the job and we expect it. One of the things that we also have grown to expect and prepare for is the possibility of infiltration and spying. This was, as you know, done to Black civil rights groups and Black leaders back in the 60s, 70s and beyond, infiltrated with informants and undercover agents to spy on their work, to undermine their work. Because when you cannot defeat someone's message, you attack the messenger and you try to undermine the messenger. And this has especially been done to people who support Palestinian human rights. You all will know that at one point, anti-apartheid activists here in the United States were spied upon because the Israeli government and the South African apartheid government had a close relationship. And so it was actually the Anti-Defamation League in California that spied on anti-apartheid activists and got sued over and had to settle a few decades ago. And of course, American Muslims are no stranger to being targeted and spied upon. It's happened to numerous Muslim organizations. Perhaps the most famous example of this was when the NYPD launched a systematic campaign of spying on Muslims in New York, on student centers, on mosques, on organizations that went on for years in the wake of 9/11 until it was exposed and shut down. So I say all that to say that spying is a serious problem. It's something that we expect and we prepare for. But nonetheless, we were certainly taken surprised by something that happened to our organization over the past few years. And that's what I want to tell you about today. Some of you may have seen the news, and if not, we're going to go into some of the detail. But to give you the headline, an anti-Muslim hate group here in the United States, working for the benefit of a foreign government, the Israeli government, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in over 10 years to infiltrate and spy upon American Muslim organizations. Let me say it again. An anti-Muslim hate group here in the United States that is a registered nonprofit organization spent over $100,000 and over 10 years infiltrating and spying upon American Muslim organizations, including mosques, civil rights groups, and individual leaders, all for the benefit of a foreign government. That is what we learned and exposed over the past year, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. And then we're going to talk about why this is so important to be aware of and what we can do to protect our work, our activism, our civil rights advocacy, our human rights advocacy from these attempts to undermine our work, God willing. I've got a limited amount of time, so I talk fast, as you can see. I'm going to try to get through this quickly because I want to make sure I can take all of your questions. And also I'll note, Grant, if at any point we're having technical difficulties, just let me know, and I will pause to make sure that we can address those issues. So what I'm going to do now is share my screen. We're going to be showing you a few items here, visual items, as I walk through this presentation. Looks like we've got screen sharing disabled. So I'm going to ask Grant to, if he can, to just make me a co-host on Zoom, and that should allow me to share my screen as I'm presenting. But until that's set up, I'll go ahead and continue. So the first thing I want to note is this. So in the fall of 2020, we at CARE received a very mysterious email from someone claiming that they had worked for an anti-Muslim hate group known as the Investigative Project on Terrorism. This is a right-wing organization founded by Stephen Emerson. Many of you may know Mr. Emerson. He is a... hold on. So this is Stephen Emerson. Mr. Emerson, Google his name. You may know him, you know, a far-right extremist. Back in 1995, he became somewhat infamous for claiming that the Oklahoma City bombing was likely perpetrated by Middle Easterners. And then over the years, he became very well-known and very prominent in right-wing circles, anti-Muslim circles. He appeared on Fox News quite a bit, and he touted himself as a so-called terrorism expert. His organization, very hostile to Muslims, very hostile to Palestinians, very supportive of the Israeli government's policies. And so he just dedicated his time, him and his organization, to targeting, smearing American Muslim leaders and organizations. Around 2015, I believe, he went on Fox and he said something that was dumb even for him. He claimed that a city in England was a no-go zone, that the police could not go there because it had been taken over by Muslims. And he was ridiculed for this. He had to apologize. The British Prime Minister, David Cameron, called him a complete idiot. And after that, he kind of was pushed out of even conservative circles. You didn't see him on Fox anymore. He became kind of a nobody, but he was still active, you know, writing his articles, posting things online. We were aware of him, obviously tracking him, but he seemed to have faded away as a serious threat to the American Muslim community. Now that brings us to the email we got about 2 years ago. A former IPT member reached out to us and said, "I've got information you may want. There is a mole in your organization." That's all this person said. Now, of course, we didn't know, is this true? Is it not true? Is this person a crackpot? We didn't know. And so over the following months, this person sent us information, a considerable amount of information about the inner workings of IPT and what they had been doing. And what this information showed pretty clearly is that there was indeed likely a mole somewhere within our civil rights organization, and that this mole had been providing private conversations, recording conversations, emails, strategy work to IPT, to this anti-Muslim hate group. Now, as many of you know, we would later find out that the person doing this was the director of CARE Columbus, Ohio, Roman Iqbal. We found that out months later. Obviously, he was, after a long investigation, he was confronted, he admitted it, and he was terminated. Now, that by itself is disturbing enough, but that is not the end of the story, because what we also learned from this whistleblower is that IPT, this organization, this hate group, is not only targeting CARE, they were targeting the broader Muslim community. They were targeting mosques. They were targeting interfaith organizations. They were targeting Muslim leaders. And they were using paid spies to do it. They were paying their staff and external spies a considerable amount of money to spy on the Muslim community, to record private conversations among Muslim leaders, to go to events undercover and record those things with hidden cameras and cameras in purses and other ridiculous things, and then turn that over to IPT. Even more disturbing, we learned what they were doing with some of this information. Let me show you a few examples. So again, their first target and main target was us, was CARE. They hate CARE because of our advocacy for not only Palestinian human rights, but against Islamophobia. So here's just one email, and don't worry if you can't read the text, I'm going to describe each of these to you. This is a conversation that Roman Iqbal passed along to IPT. As you all know, government officials often appear before Congress and to answer questions, and civil rights groups and advocacy groups will often encourage members of Congress to ask questions of those government officials. Perfectly normal work. So, of course, CARE did that at a hearing, and Mr. Iqbal then informed IPT that, hey, look, CARE gave some suggested questions to Representative Keith Ellison to ask of the FBI director. This is just one example of information he was sharing. Anything about our national work, our strategic work, was what Roman Iqbal wanted to get a hold of and wanted to pass along, especially anything related to our interactions with government and to our advocacy for human rights, in particular, Palestine. I guess this is another email in which you can see Stephen Emerson saying to his own staff, quote, Roman is covering this event, a Hill Day, a Capitol Hill Day in New York. Roman is covering this for us, so be prepared for an avalanche of incoming tapes during that period. So again, this is how they were targeting us internally. But again, not just us. They were also going after external Muslim leaders and organizations. Let's talk about that now. One of the most disturbing examples we have, many of you recall the controversy over Park 51. So back in 2010, anti-Muslim hate groups rallied opposition to the expansion of a Muslim community center located several blocks away from the World Trade Center site. What we found out through this whistleblower is that IPT managed to infiltrate one, if not more, national Muslim strategy calls about how to address that controversy. They recorded that conversation, produced a massive transcript of it, turned it over to IPT. Park 51, Sister Daisy Khan, one of the leaders of that project, believes that that infiltration allowed anti-Muslim hate groups to predict their moves and undermine their moves and eventually cause serious harm to that project. This is just the first page of a very long transcript that IPT created of that conversation. You can see here that nearly every major Muslim organization, CARE, IMPAC, Zaytuna College, the Islamic Society of North America, the Institute for Social Policy Understanding, other Muslim organizations were recorded on this call. It's important to note that what IPT was doing, paying people to spy, was not only unethical, it was in some cases illegal. As you all know, to record someone without permission in numerous states is against the law. Yet IPT was systematically doing that to Muslim leaders across and organizations across the country. Now, we also learned some other things I'm not going to go into, but IPT, we learned, very abusive to their staff. This is a subject line that Mr. Emerson sent to his staff. And if you can't read it, it says, to all the effing idiots who work for me. And he's very upset because his people had apparently missed recording some Arab Spring event being held at Georgetown University. Here's another email where he's cursing at his staff, threatening to fire people because they missed coverage of an event held by the Muslim Association of North America, the Muslim Alliance of North America. That's an African-American Muslim group based in New York. Now, that also disturbing, but not the end of the story. We also learned that not collaborating and working with and providing assistance to the Israeli government. Let's show you a few emails we have here. So as you can see here, the title of this email. Mr. Emerson allegedly sends an email from his he forwards an email from the office of Prime Minister Netanyahu to his own staff, and the title of this is Urgent Research Request from Netanyahu Office. Quote, this is an urgent high priority request from the office of PM Netanyahu. Who can work on this right now? This is urgent, Steve. Mr. Emerson, according to these emails, was allegedly in touch with multiple Israeli intelligence officials, including Idol Mizrahi, who identifies himself in his emails as a senior intelligence official working in Netanyahu's office, as well as General Yossi Kuperwasser, who is a former Israeli general, also worked in Israeli intelligence. And in these emails, you can see numerous conversations. At one point, the Israeli government asks IPT, do you have any information connecting Students for Justice in Palestine, the American college student group, to Hamas? This is, they are reaching out to an American nonprofit organization, asking this organization, this hate group that's spying on Muslims, for information about SJP college students, American college students. And again, you can see these emails, and this is online, by the way, if you can't read any of these. So again, what this indicated to us is that not only was Mr. Emerson targeting American Muslims, spreading Islamophobia, he was at the same time actively collaborating with and working with a foreign government. Now, the next thing I want to note here is, and if you go and read some of these in details online, you'll also see Mr. Emerson mentioning his travels to Tel Aviv, meeting with these intelligence officials in person. So God knows whatever else they were saying to each other that we don't know about yet. Now, I want to note that we were able to find this out, all this out, because a brave whistleblower within IPT decided to come forward and tell us what was going on. And in addition to that, after we gathered a lot of this information, we were able to identify another spy, not in our organization, in the broader Muslim community. That person voluntarily came forward before anyone confronted him and confessed and offered to help and provided us extensive information. Through him, we were able to learn that IPT was paying money to spies to do this work, and we were also able to learn more about IPT's motivations. I'm going to show you now just two quotes from each of these whistleblowers. They have full statements we posted online, but I'm just going to show you a few quotes that talk about motive. So this is the whistleblower who worked within IPT. This is what they said to us. This is a direct quote from them in their public statement. I came to realize that IPT's main concern was not protecting our nation from legitimate threats, but protecting a foreign government, Israel, from legitimate criticism. We were essentially being used as an Israel lobbying organization. Demonizing people who simply have opinions we may not agree with has become sport, yet I was doing it as part of my job. Now, this person, I want to say, we're not identifying their name publicly, but they have spoken, obviously, to some reporters. But I want to say that they are incredibly brave, and they are a testament to the human capacity to change, to recognize that we've done something wrong, and then to do the right thing. This person spent years targeting American Muslims, trying to undermine the fight for Palestinian human rights, and they came around. They realized what they were doing was wrong, and they stepped up and they did the right thing to try to make things right. And that's why we as Muslims, I would say, we always try to make sure that we give people a chance to do the right thing. We always try to make sure that we recognize our opponents, even our enemies, are human beings, and they all have the capacity, the ability to change for the better. And so I just want to say about this individual, we are so appreciative of their doing the right thing, of recognizing that the Muslim community is a part of America and does not deserve to be treated this way, and recognizing that Palestinian human rights matter. And I want to share a quote from another individual. This is the second person. Now, this is a Muslim who spied on the community and was paid about $3,000 a month, give or take, for 4 years to spy on our community, in particular, Black Muslims and Representative Keith Ellison. IPT compiled like a 60-page dossier on Keith Ellison, and they were obsessed. I mean obsessed with anything this man thought or said about Palestinian human rights, about American policy towards Palestine. In fact, we learned that at one point they infiltrated and secretly recorded a private fundraiser that Mr. Ellison spoke at, in which he was critical of American foreign policy in the Middle East towards Israel and Palestine. IPT took that audio recording, held on to it, and then leaked it when Keith Ellison was running for chairman of the Democratic National Committee. At that point, the ADL attacked him, other organizations attacked him, and that harmed his campaign for DNC chair. So I want to now read to you a quote from the person who did that recording, another spy for IPT who, again, recognized what they did was wrong, quit, and confessed. Here's the quote. Hold on. There we go. Oh, hold on. Looks like I've got double quotes here. But what he said is that he came to realize that IPT's main goal in doing all of this was to make sure that there would never be, and this is a quote from him, a Muslim version of AIPAC. His goal was to make sure that the Muslim community would never become powerful enough to change American foreign policy in the Middle East in a more humanitarian, just way, a fairer way. Changing American foreign policy towards Israel and Palestine. He said that was IPT's main goal in targeting Muslims. Yes, they're anti-Muslim. Yes, they're Islamophobic. But the main reason they put so much time and energy in doing all this was to undermine Muslims, swamp us dealing with bigotry so we can't improve American foreign policy in the Middle East. Now, again, if that was the end of the story, disturbing enough, but again, not the end of the story. The last piece of this puzzle is that IPT, again, was using and spending a considerable amount of money to pay these spies and their staff to do this work. Where'd they get this money from? Well, we just released a report just a few months ago that was a follow-up to a report released in 2017. The report is called Islamophobia in the Mainstream. This report looks at foundations, mainstream charitable foundations, that are giving money to anti-Muslim hate groups. What we do is we look at the list of prominent anti-Muslim hate groups. We then check to see where they're getting their donations from. And we also look at foundations, the biggest foundations in America, and look to see who are they giving money to. And then we check and cross-check to see where are we seeing a match here. And so in 2017, we released a report showing that about $150 million had been funneled from mainstream charities, foundations to anti-Muslim hate groups. We exposed that. We spoke out against it. And then we did a follow-up report, again, just a few months ago, that showed that the number dropped by almost $50 million, a $50 million reduction in the amount of money going from charitable foundations to anti-Muslim hate groups. But still a massive amount of money, $105 million, give or take. And this is just of the 50 largest charitable organizations in the United States that we surveyed. One of those anti-Muslim hate groups that got a lot of money from mainstream foundations was IPT. And we also know from public reporting, from thanks to the work of journalists, that what IPT has done in some cases is take money from IP, the nonprofit, transfer it allegedly to SAE Productions, which is a for-profit company run by Stephen Emerson. And it's SAE Productions that is then used to pay the spy that was used to pay one of the spies they had in the Muslim community. We know that because that spy gave us his tax form, literally showing money coming from SAE production. So what kind of money did IPT get? You can see this tax form here. And again, if you can't read it, don't worry. I'm going to still tell you what it says. This is in just 2017 through a donor advised fund run by Fidelity Charitable Gift Fund. IPT got $67,240 in 2017. That's $67,000 in 1 year, in 2017. Keep in mind, for just 1 year of spying, IPT paid about $3,000 a month over 12 months, right? So this $67,000 a year could easily cover the amount of money they would have to pay a spy to target the Muslim community. Who else is giving the money? Schwab Charitable Fund, another donor-advised fund. And for those of you who don't know, a donor-advised fund, so you give the money to a Schwab Charitable Fund. You recommend who you want that money to go to. You get an immediate tax write-off, even if Schwab doesn't give the money away as a donation right away. And then Schwab can give that money to any properly registered nonprofit organization. But again, they will usually listen to your recommendation, give the money to who you recommend the money would go to. And of course, this provides a level of privacy for the person donating the money, because we don't know who is donating to these donor advised funds often. So Schwab Charitable Fund passed $51,000 to IPT in 2017. The Jewish Communal Fund, $82,000 to IPT, also in 2017. You can see the tax form here. the Abstraction Fund. This is a right-wing anti-Palestinian fund, $55,000 to IPT in 2018. The Diana Davis Spencer Foundation, $300,000 to IPT, $300,000 in 2018. So again, that's just a two-year period, and that's just a small sample of the kind of money that was being passed around. And so when you ask yourself, how is IPT getting the money to spy on the American Muslim community, to undermine the community on behalf of a foreign government, this is part of where they are getting that money to target our community. Let me stop sharing screen now. So now we look at all this, and we look at it together, and we wonder, again, what was the impact of all this? So first and foremost, it's important to note that in all this spying, the ironic thing is that IPT was not able to find anything harmful about American Muslim organizations or mosques. 10 years of spying and all their nonsense about you're tied to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood and your terrorists, all this foolishness, they got nothing because there is nothing. Right. These are all just anti-Muslim bigotry. It's all just hateful things they say, because, again, they want to attack the messenger. They want to undermine the messenger. And so they got an inside look at what Muslims are doing for over 10 years, and they know there's nothing there. Yet why do they keep doing this work? Because, as the whistleblower said, the reason IPT is doing this is because they want to undermine and weaken the American Muslim community so that we cannot speak up for Palestinian human rights. That is the main goal. Yes, I'm sure they hate Islam. They hate the fact that Muslims, we believe that there is one God and no God but God, and that Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, is a messenger of God. I'm sure they hate us for that belief. But the thing they really, really hate is that we take our Islamic values and we put it into action by advocating for human rights for all people, not just Uyghurs, not just Rohingya, not just the Jewish community, not just Christians. We advocate for all people, and that includes Palestinian human rights. That's what they hate. These people are terrified that American Muslims become politically powerful in this country and use our voices to change American foreign policy in a new or more humane and just way. That's what they're afraid of. They are afraid that we will reorient American foreign policy in a more just and humane direction, especially towards Palestinians. And you know what? They are right to be afraid. That is exactly what we've been doing, and it's exactly what we are going to continue doing, God willing, no matter how much they may hate it. That is our duty in this country, to speak up for justice here and abroad. And the fact that these anti-Muslim hate groups and anti-Palestinian racists have found common cause with each other or share these ideologies in one person and then come after us, again, we consider that a good sign, and it makes us feel like we've got to continue doing this work. Last thing I'll say is, what do we do to protect ourselves from this? The key thing that I've said, that we've said in the Muslim community, our director Nihad Awad has said this, and I say it as well, we cannot let this sort of infiltration and spying lead us to become paranoid, lead us to become suspicious of each other. No. We have got to think the best of the people we're working with. We can't assume the worst about people. We've just got to keep our heads up and keep doing our work. The one thing these hate groups would love more than anything is to divide us. The anti-Palestinian, anti-Muslim crowd has spent years not only attacking our community, but trying to divide us, trying to say to Muslims, look, why do you all just be quiet? Just focus on civil rights here at home. Just worry about Islamophobia. Be quiet. Don't worry about the Palestinians. Just be quiet. And if you do that, we'll leave you alone. No deal. We're not going to do that, right? But that's what they want. They want to do that. And if they can't do that, they want to divide us, right? They want us being suspicious of each other, turning on each other. And our community is not going to let that happen. And the broader human rights community, no matter your religion, whether you're Muslim, Jewish, Christian, secular, humanist, Buddhist, Hindu, whatever, if you are in the fight for human rights, don't let infiltration and spying make you suspicious of the people you are working with. These things that happen, they happen. But at the end of the day, we are all doing good work. We have nothing to hide and therefore nothing to be afraid of. We just got to keep doing our work, and God willing, we will win. Sooner or later. That's why they hate us. That's why they're doing this. And it only emboldens us to keep doing our work. Again, I want to thank you all for having me today. And I will wrap up now and welcome any questions that you may have.
You have been listening to Attorney Edward Ahmed Mitchell speaking at the annual conference of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM, every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can also stream us live on Sunday evenings at KKRN.org at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved in the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.